Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. Great big giant Wednesday show. Second hour, Carlo Broussard will be here, and we're going to talk about overcoming obstacles to the Catholic faith. This hour, Dr. George Delgado is our guest, and it is a pro-life open forum. If you have questions having to do with life and the care for the living in many stages of life, from conception to natural death, you're welcome to give us a call, 888-318-7884. That's 888-318-7884. Dr. Delgado is the medical director of the Culture of Life Family Healthcare. He's the medical director also of Abortion Pill Reversal. He practices family medicine, providing medical care that's faithful to the teachings of the Catholic Church. And that abortion pill reversal, that is something that you are a pioneer in, if I may say so. Is that correct, Dr. Delgado?
That's correct. Thank you very much.
And thanks so much for being with us. Just to be so that people know, because I think some people will be shocked to hear this, having not heard you before, but a woman might take a pill or a series of pills to abort a child and then change her mind. As a matter of fact, the changing the mind part might be more common than you think. But now something can be done about that once if she changes her mind.
That's right. And this medical abortion or abortion pill called mifepristone, previously called RU-46, is now approved in the United States to cause an abortion up to 10 weeks of pregnancy. So now 35% to 45% of all abortions in our country are accomplished using mifepristone instead of via a surgical abortion.
So that is good news indeed. And now, is that connected to the fact that what I have heard is you're beginning award from the Solidarity Health Share at the around the time of the Walk for Life in Washington, D.C.?
Yes, they've decided to give me an award they give out yearly at their annual banquet, which is the night before the March for Life in Washington, D.C. So I'm very humbled to be receiving that, and also glad that I'll be able to talk a little bit about abortion pill reversal and the research that we're going to be carrying out in the future under the auspices of the Steno Institute, which is a research institute I founded in the last several months, which will focus on abortion pill reversal research to further the protocols, to refine them, to find out what works the best, and also eventually to branch out into other areas of pro-life research, because this is really sorely needed, because so many areas of research around life, there is such a great bias in the mainstream medical professions that we really need something that's unbiased, that allows us to look at these areas and bring good quality research to the table so that we can further our cause.
Yeah, you get the sense that the media, as it's currently constituted in much of the world, isn't really in favor of babies. They don't really like babies very much. I know they wouldn't like it classified that way, but it doesn't seem like an entirely implausible way to describe it.
Right. It's not just the media. It's also the medical profession as a whole. Even the profession that delivers babies, you think they'd like babies. They're the profession, the specialty that's most against babies by being the provider and the promoter of abortion and of contraception. So it's really very quite ironic.
Well, you know who does love babies is Mary, the Mother of God. And today is the Feast of Our Lady of Guadalupe, so a very happy Feast of Our Lady to you. And this is a perfect day to be doing a pro-life open forum. 888-318-7884 is our number, 888-318-7884. If you have questions about abortion or about the care of children in the womb, the care of mothers who are carrying babies, you're welcome to call 888-318-7884. If you have end-of-life questions about caring for those who are in the dying stages or approaching the dying stages of life or maybe incapacitated by a disability or a difficulty, a disease of some sort, all of that is just right in our wheelhouse this hour as we do a pro-life open forum, 888-318-7884. Dr. Delgado, something that I'm scared of, and maybe you will talk me out of being scared of it, but I am scared of it, is this CRISPR technology, this kind of cut-and-paste gene editing technology. It frightens me. And recently, we had an announcement from a scientist in China, one that is, I guess it's not entirely clear whether it's verified or not, but he claims to have edited the genes of two babies in utero before they were born. What do you know about this, and should I be scared or not?
Well, you know, you shouldn't be scared of CRISPR because CRISPR, like you said, is a kind of cut-and-paste technology for gene editing. It can be used for a lot of good things. For example, you could edit the genes in mosquitoes so that they no longer can transmit malaria, or scientists have used them to create bacteria that can decompose plastics. And eventually, this technology will probably be used to treat people with certain diseases so that they will no longer have those diseases. What gets dicey and what should concern us is when CRISPR is used on embryos and if it's used on germ lines. And germ lines are the cells that make the eggs in a woman and the sperm in a man. Because then the gene that is changed will be passed on to generation to generation. That can be of concern because if there's a mistake, then the mistake is amplified and propagated, and then there might not be a way to stop it. Whereas if you're, let's say, treating an adult with a certain disease and you modify the genes in order to improve the disease, let's say there's a mistake, well, then that adult or patient will suffer, just like he or she could suffer from the side effects or the adverse effects of any other treatment. So I think that the ethics here, we really have to be very careful that we avoid doing this on germ cells, and these are cells that make the sperm and the eggs because of what I said before. But also we have to be very careful when the scientists in China purportedly did this not on babies in utero, but instead babies in vitro in glass, in the test tube. And so that, of course, implies that there was in vitro fertilization, which we, of course, we know that is intrinsically immoral because of how it violates the right of the embryonic person to be conceived within the marital embrace of a husband and wife. Instead, that person is created in a laboratory involving at least one third party, the scientist putting the sperm and the eggs together. So there's already the presumption that there is an immoral creation of that person, which, of course, doesn't affect the value and the sanctity of the life of that person, but just means that person has already been violated from in its own creation by how that person was created. And it puts the person at great risk because they're plucking cells off of that small embryo and then altering them and then putting them back. And so that is a risk because the integrity of that embryo is being challenged and possibly damaged by plucking off those cells. So it really involves a lot of things that make us pause, and really we need to be very, very careful with this. And certainly anything like this where it involves in vitro fertilization, we should stay away from that. And if it involves great risk to the embryo, we also should stay away from that.
Already, indeed. We have lots and lots of callers on the line already. It is a pro-life open forum. Dr. George Delgado is well prepared to answer your questions, prepared both as an ethicist and as a physician. And we're happy to take your calls, 888-318-7884. How about we start with Marie in Spokane, Washington, listening on the EWTN app. Marie, your question for Dr. Delgado.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. My 20-year-old son and I were just having this conversation last night, and he understands that the church allows natural family planning for couples in order to have some flexibility in planning pregnancies due to financial constraints or if the wife is overly, you know, mentally or physically burdened by being pregnant every year. He understands that. But if the church allows us to prevent or cure diseases, by using artificial means like getting the flu vaccine or over-the-counter painkillers and cold medicines and stuff like that, instead of trusting our natural immune systems, which NFP would be doing to prevent pregnancy using the woman's fertility, then why is using an artificial method of preventing a pregnancy bad? And my first response to him was that the flu or the cold or, arthritis is kind of an aggressor and a pregnancy isn't. But then his response to that was, well, that's not true, because the reason the couple is using NFP is because it would be a big burden on them right now to have another baby. So he does see that as not necessarily an aggressor, but a burden and bad for them.
So if what we need is an explanation of why we can use medicines to battle things like bacteria and viruses, but we don't use artificial means to prevent pregnancy. Is that right, Marie?
Yeah. Basically, he wants to know why the artificial method using painkillers and stuff is okay.
Right. So I see what you're saying, Marie. And really, the use of the words artificial and natural are not very helpful in this discussion, because that's not really the differentiating point. We can use artificial things all we want as long as we're keeping with God's plan. And in fact, people who use fertility monitors to help with their NFP, those are artificial devices. Those are perfectly fine to use. So it's not that it's really natural. It's really that the difference is that when you give a medication that, let's say, is an artificial medication or a vaccine, let's say, that is produced in ethical ways, you're not going against God's plan. You're using our collective intelligence and technologies to better human health. Now, however, if you used a vaccine, let's say, that was produced in a way that destroyed human embryos, which some of them are, have an association with the destruction of human embryos and fetuses, then, and there was not a good reason to use that vaccine, then you would be going against God's design, and that would be immoral. Now, what it is with the contraception and natural family planning, and by the way, some of us are getting away from the term natural family planning and are going towards something called fertility awareness. That might be a better word to use for this discussion. So if you use fertility awareness, what you're doing is you're respecting God's design and you're taking advantage of the infertile times in the cycle. And sometimes, like I said, using artificial means to know when those infertile times are, and having intercourse during those infertile times, and abstaining during the fertile times in order not to conceive. So it's simply a strategy of when you have intercourse. It's really nothing artificial or natural about it. It's just a strategy. However, with contraception, and we could even include coitus interruptus with contraception. Coitus interruptus is when the male withdraws before the time of climax, and that's been used for thousands of years as a form of regulating births. And so that is not at all artificial if you think about it, but that, as well as all of contraception, goes against God's design. It goes against God's design by either circumventing, altering, or blocking the natural God-given fertility design. So that's exactly what happens with contraception. It's going against God's plan by either altering it, circumventing it, or blocking it. While fertility awareness programs, a.k.a. natural family planning, simply observe the cycles in natural and artificial ways. You know when you're infertile, you have intercourse when you're infertile, and then you don't get pregnant because you're not having intercourse during the fertile time. So that's really the fundamental difference. It's a fundamental difference of honoring God's design, not whether it's artificial or natural. Does that make sense?
Marie?
Yeah, I think so. Yes, I think so, and I think he would probably accept that. But he might also say that, well, isn't it part of God's design that people get diseases, but we're treating those artificially?
Yeah, no, it's not God's design that we get diseases. It's God's design that we be healthy, vital people. Diseases came about with the fall, with original sin. So if Adam and Eve had not committed original sin, we would not have any diseases. So diseases is part of the decay of the human race that occurred because of the fall. And so it's not, it was not originally part of God's plan. But like everything else, God will take something that is bad or even evil and turn it into good. And so when we do get diseases, sometimes that suffering draws us closer to God, and there God turns the tables, just like he did with the crucifixion. The crucifixion, killing the Son of Man, was in itself, it was a sin. It was an evil that Judas betrayed God, betrayed Jesus, and that he was crucified. However, God took that and used it as a means of salvation. So he took something that was evil and turned it into good. And that's what God does with diseases and other hardships that we have.
We got to leave it there. Marie, I hope indeed that that was helpful to you. We've got two great specials running today at shop.catholic.com. All of our digital products, ebooks, e-magazines, MP3s are 50% off all week. So you go to shop.catholic.com to get that. And you can also save money on hundreds of other items in our shop. Just enter the code CALIVE18 at checkout when you visit shop.catholic.com and save 30% on hundreds of books, DVDs, CDs, and other stuff in our online store. CALIVE18 at checkout at shop.catholic.com.
We're glad you're with us. Stick around for more Catholic Answers Live.
What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
How is it possible that God created everything?
Why do I need to confess my sins to
why
a priest?
Why is the Catholic Church so unwilling to
The Catholic Church is too rich.
Catholics worship Mary and are committed.
As far as I'm concerned, all religions are equal.
You are called to communion with Dr. David Anders. Tonight, 11 p.m. Eastern, on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite monks of Wyoming. Delicious mystic monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All mystic monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase mystic monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, pro-life open forum this hour. If you have a question about what the Catholic Church teaches, what the truth is about human life in its earliest stages, in its middle stages, in its latest stages, those questions are all welcome today. Dr. George Delgado is our guest. Dr. Delgado practices family medicine and is trained at the National Catholic Bioethics Center in bioethics. So he's just the guy to talk to. 888-318-7884 is the number. 888-318-7884. We go now to Ernie in Northwest Ohio, listening on 87.9 FM Annunciation Radio. Ernie, your question for Dr. George Delgado.
Good evening, Cyan, Dr. Delgado. Wonderful topic tonight and far from being worn out. So thank you for taking it on.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Dr. Delgado, I wanted to hit on the subject of brain death and vital organ harvesting. And I want to be as specific as I can with this to get a specific answer from you. So I've followed this thread for a long time and have read on it for perhaps the last 20 years. So I think I have a nice layman's understanding of these issues. What my specific question is, if a patient who is compromised, who is being lined up to be a vital organ donor, and they are being sustained with life supports, and then their organs are deliberately harvested, how do we know that that patient, the moment before the harvesting of the organs, which then ceases all functions, how do we know that their soul has already left their body?
Well, that's a great question. We really have no way of knowing the moment of death. We are pretty good at predicting that death has already occurred. And so there's that interval to which you're alluding that we don't know where we are. So I think it's reasonable when you're talking about organ harvesting from supposedly dead people, that there needs to be some interval of time where you have some moral certainty that death truly has occurred, and death, and from our context, would be, like you said, separation of the soul from the physical body. Now, you also bring up the concept of brain death, which is, I would say, it's accepted in the mainline medical profession, but I think that there are some holes in the so-called doctrine of brain death. It's important to know that brain death, the definition was originally devised back in Harvard as a way to increase the harvesting of organs, because there's an organ shortage. And so they reason that, well, there may be some patients who are actually dead, but whose hearts and lungs are being kept alive by life support, but that the entire person is actually dead, just the tissues are being kept alive, and that it would be acceptable to take organs from them. Now, in principle, if a person truly is dead and we can verify that, then it would be fine to take organs from them, because you're essentially taking organs from a corpse that is being maintained by the heart and lungs that are being artificially controlled. However, the problems with this are, number one, can we be absolutely sure that the brain is truly the locus of control of the human organism? Or rather, is it not? And we really have, it's difficult to prove that, because if we look from a metaphysical standpoint, the soul really is the animating force of a person. And the soul is really distinct from the brain, where the brain is really a physical organ. And that kind of integrates and manages everything, but if it is it truly the ultimate integrating force? So that's the first question. The second question is, are we fully confident that we are precise and accurate every time when we make a diagnosis of brain death? I do not think so. The reason why is that there are cases of children who have been diagnosed as being brain dead, but whose parents insisted on them being kept on ventilators, which are breathing machines, and those children have gone through menopause. There's at least one documented case of that. Now, to go through menopause, you have to have certain areas of the brain functioning, an area called the hypothalamus, which is part of the brain. So that, to me, is proof that at least that one child was not truly brain dead.
Was that puberty, by the way? Did you?
Pardon me?
They went through puberty?
You went through puberty, yes.
Yeah, I got it. Okay.
Yeah. So, and then there's also a case of a child who was in Oakland, California, a couple of years ago, who was declared brain dead, and the Children's Hospital there was ready to take her off of the life support without the consent of the mother, and they actually even produced a death certificate. The mother was able to have the child transferred after much legal maneuvering and fight by the hospital to, I believe, a skilled nursing facility in New Jersey, where she remained on life support and remained alive for many, many months. Now, if she were truly brain dead, even though she were on life support, which is a ventilator, the integration of her physiologic functions would not be able to, it would not be maintainable. So I think that's pretty good evidence that child was not dead, was not brain dead. So we have all these cases that are fairly disturbing. So I think the only way to do this with moral certainty would be to take the person who is presumed to be brain dead off of the life support, see that the heart stops beating, and then wait some prescribed amount of time, 1 to 5 minutes, whatever you choose, and then you could say with pretty good certainty, yes, that patient is dead, and then you would harvest the organs. Now, the transplant surgeons and all of their proponents don't necessarily like that, because they want the freshest organs as possible. But we as a society, from an ethical standpoint, we have to insist that organs only be taken from people that we know are dead, not that from people that we're declaring dead but may not actually be dead.
Ernie, how does that all strike you?
Well, we're almost there yet. It was interesting you made the comment earlier, supposedly dead. So that question lingers. And when we go back to that 1968 Harvard definition of brain death, I can't see it as have been done for benevolent reasons. I can only think that the goodness in that, if there was any, has deteriorated up to this point with such a huge market behind organ donation. But when we look at a patient that's in line for harvesting, and they're breathing, and they're putting out urine, and they're menstruating, all of the attributes of a body animated with the soul, I would just be thinking that our theologians would look at that and say,
"All right, well, Ernie, we got the point. We're going to let Dr. Delgado respond on the other side. Right back after this on Catholic Answers Live."
Waiting for your call. Grab that line and get on board.
A generation ago, Christian parents didn't have to worry about how to explain transgenderism to their 9-year-old children or help their teenager deal with mockery at school for believing in traditional marriage. But today, as our culture decays, we have to know how to talk to our children about these issues. In Made This Way, How to Prepare Kids to Face Today's Tough Moral Issues, Layla Miller and Trent Horn give parents the crucial tools and techniques to form children with the understanding they need, appropriate to their age and maturity level, to meet the world's challenges. If we're not teaching our children how to understand tough moral issues, then the world will. Read Made This Way and learn how to give your kids a firm foundation on which to build a life of moral clarity and happiness. Order your copy of Made This Way today by calling 1-888-291-8000 or logging onto the shop at Catholic.com.
Christmas is coming, and with Advent already upon us, we want to make sure you know about our annual Christmas sale with hundreds of great faith-building resources all on sale at 20% off when you enter promo code CALIVE18 at checkout. With great new resources by Jimmy Akin, Trent Horn, Christopher Check, and other great Catholic teachers, there's simply no better time to stock up on resources to build up your faith and the faith of those around you. Phone 888-291-8000 or go to shop.catholic.com right now to take advantage of what is truly the best Catholic sale on the internet, going on now through the end of the year. And remember, enter promo code CALIVE18 at checkout to save 20% on hundreds of great resources throughout the store.
Tomorrow on More to Life. Don't talk to me like that.
We'll look at ways to respond to the cruel and unkind things people sometimes say.
Now, back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, open forum. Dr. George Delgado, our guest this hour. Our topic, well, it's a pro-life open forum. If you have any questions about life and its various stages and how what is the proper way to treat that life, certainly a contentious topic in modern times, but not one that a morally serious person should find so difficult. I mean, there certainly are clear lines that we don't want to cross, like taking the lives of innocent people and that kind of thing. But applying those ideas, those moral teachings that you will find in the natural law and within the Catholic Church, it takes some thinking. And we're happy to think through it with you. If you'd like to give a call, 888-318-7884. Dr. George Delgado, again, our guest. And Ernie was just finishing up his point before we had to go to the break real quick there, Dr. Delgado, about organ donation and the fact that he's just not convinced, and it sounds like you're not convinced, that those who are harvesting organs are always careful that the donor is in fact deceased.
Right. And yeah, just to wrap up that question, the child at Children's Hospital in Oakland was Jahai McMath. She was a 13-year-old who was, like I said, declared brain dead. After she was transferred back to the East Coast, she ended up living 4 years. And there's no way a person would live 4 years or whose heart would keep going for 4 years if she were brain dead, because what the ventilator does is it moves oxygen through the through the lungs, and then oxygenates the blood, so the heart heart can beat on its own. But in order for everything to be regulated relatively well to last 4 years, that part of the brain had to have been working. So in my mind, this Jahi McMath was not brain dead. And so we clearly have cases where mistakes are made or that show us that this concept of brain death is really not death of the organism of the person. So I agree with Ernie. We have to be very careful with that.
888-318-7884, the number. Again, pro-life open forum. Let us go. Oh, you know what? This caller actually dropped Hope in Buffalo, New York, called, and she just wrote this, or gave us this, and so I'll read it to you. I'm a pro-life Catholic OBGYN. Is there an ethical treatment for an ectopic pregnancy? What is your opinion, Dr. Delgado?
There definitely is, and for the sake of our audience, what is meant by ectopic pregnancy is when the human embryo implants in a place other than the inside of the uterus. The most common place for ectopic pregnancy is the tube. That's why it's often called a tubal pregnancy, probably about 90% of them. But they also can implant in the abdomen, sometimes on the cervix and other places. Well, with tubal pregnancy, there is no real controversy amongst Catholic ethicists that the treatment called salpingectomy is ethically appropriate. And that is a treatment where the portion of the tube where the embryo has lodged and implanted is cut out. And so here we apply what's called the principle of double effect. There's one treatment that is cutting out of the diseased tube. The tube is diseased because the embryo should not be implanted there. In cutting out that tube, you're doing two things. One, you're saving the mother's life because if it's left there, the tube will explode and maybe cause her to bleed to death. But the second effect that is foreseen but not wanted, not desired, is the end of that embryo's life. And the two, the bad effect and the good effect, are of equal magnitude because both their lives are of equal magnitude, and there's no better way to handle this situation. So in that case, it's perfectly acceptable. There are two other treatments for tubal pregnancy. I'm going to go to the one that most good Catholic bioethicists feel is probably morally illicit, that is not acceptable, and that is giving a drug called methotrexate. Methotrexate is a anti-cancer drug that can be given in these instances. It works or inhibits rapidly dividing cells. And where are cells rapidly dividing? We're, of course, in the human embryo. And what this does is it causes death of the embryo, and particularly the susceptible cells of the embryo are called the chorion. Now, the chorion is what becomes the placenta. At this time, early in the pregnancy, however, the chorion really should be considered part and parcel of the embryo, not as some separate structure. So really, by attacking the chorion, you really are attacking the embryo. So this drug really directly is a direct attack on the embryo. So the principle of double effect is not appropriately applied here because it's not one action that has two effects. It's one action that has one effect, and that effect is the death of the embryonic person. By killing the embryonic person, it stops growing, so therefore you save the tube. So you can see there that the good effect flows from the bad effect, not two effects flowing from one action. So therefore, that would not be acceptable. The one that is controversial is called salpingostomy. Salpingostomy is when an incision is made in the tube and the embryo and its chorion are separated from the tube. Now, there is a recent article in the Catholic Medical Association journal called Lineker Journal, and L-I-N-A-C-R-E. And in here, a good colleague and a good friend of mine, Dr. Donna Harrison, whom I respect a great deal, writes a very compelling argument that salpingostomy actually should be considered morally licit because it is separation of a chorion, which is improperly implanted in the tube, or it shouldn't be. That's why it's called ectopic, not in the right place. And that therefore it is not a direct attack on the embryo, and that it is analogous to the salpingectomy, which is also which is more of a separation of the diseased tube and the embryo from the mother. Well, I think that still is a bit controversial. I'm not totally convinced by her argument, but I think it is a very compelling argument. So I would include that salpingostomy as a gray area. The church itself has not made a pronouncement on salpingostomy or even methotrexate, but on salpingectomy, we have said that, yes, that is an allowable treatment if there's no better treatment. In the future, we hope to have a way to take that embryo out and transplant that embryo into the same mother's uterus. There are scientists working on this with animal models to see if they can do that. There have been a few tries in humans that mostly have been unsuccessful, although there was a case report from many, many years ago that it was successful, but more recent tries have been unsuccessful.
Thank you very much. And we always appreciate when doctors or medical professionals call. We get a lot of those kind of calls or questions when you're on, Dr. Delgado, and we're happy to be helpful if we can to those practicing medicine. We go now to Lori in Washington State, listening to EWTN on Sirius Satellite, channel 130. Lori, your question for Dr. Delgado.
Hi. First, I'd like to say thank you so much, Dr. Delgado, for your research into trying to develop the APR. I am a pro-life person. I'm out at Planned Parenthood daily. I'm a 40 Days for Life leader and a sidewalk advocate for life. I'm also a really good friend of someone I'm sure you know pretty well, Dr. Donna Harrison. She is the executive director of APLOG, the American Academy of Pro-Life OBGYNs. And
I serve on the board of APLOG.
The work you're doing to help us out there be able to give people real solutions to things. And so thank you so much. My question today is, could you be a little bit more, give more clarification about how the APR works? I'm a physical therapist and I do understand it, but one of the things that as a pro-life worker, I'd like to be able to explain it to somebody in a way, because we know when some people are taking the pills where I am located, we know that they're taking them because they actually have appointments for the pill versus the surgical. What's the best way to get that that word out? And also to medical professionals who seem to be very, very unaware. I had a discussion with a nurse last week who was a surgical nurse who had no idea that any of this existed.
Okay. So are you asking what's the best way to explain how it works, how the process works, or what's the best way to promote APR?
Both.
Both. Okay. All right. So let's start with the first one. So APR, abortion pill reversal, is a process whereby we can stop a medical abortion. The way the medical abortion pill works, the first medication is called mifepristone. It's a progesterone receptor blocker. And progesterone, as the name implies, progesterone, is essential for a normal, healthy pregnancy. Now, when mifepristone is given and it blocks progesterone receptors, then it negates the good effect of the progesterone. The placenta separates from the uterus and the embryo or the fetus dies. A simple way to explain this concept is using a key and lock analogy. A key goes into a lock, it turns the lock, and a door opens. The door opening is the good hormone effect. The key is the hormone, progesterone. The lock is the receptor. All of us have had the experience of putting a key into a lock, but the lock didn't turn. We call that a false key. That's analogous to the mifepristone. It blocks the receptor. It blocks the lock. So that false key goes in. The lock does not turn, so the door never opens, and you do not have the good effect of the progesterone. Fortunately, these keys are going in and out of the lock. They don't just sit there forever. So when the bad key comes out, there's a chance that a good key could go in. If we give supplemental progesterone like we do with APR, then we have more of the good guy keys lined up in front of that lock. So when the bad key comes out, it's more likely that a good key will go in there, turn the lock, and open the door, and we'll have the good hormone effect. And we give that supplemental progesterone to outcompete that bad key until the bad keys wash out of the system. That's how it works, and I think that's a good analogy to explain to people who maybe don't have much of a medical background. As far as how to get the word out, the best way is for people like you to be talking to all medical professionals that they know talk to pregnancy resource centers, pregnancy medical clinics. If they want to join the network, they can go to the website abortionpillrescue.com. The program itself is now a program of Heartbeat International, and they've renamed it as Abortion Pill Rescue. The URL, abortionpillreversal.com, still works, but either one, Abortion Pill Reversal or abortionpillrescue.com. They can go there and get information on how to join the network of physicians, nurse practitioners, physician assistants, and midwives. And also there's a large network now of pregnancy resource centers that are medical. They can join and then be available, because these women are going to be changing their minds. We've demonstrated that they do sometimes change their minds, and they're going to be seeking help in the pro-life places. So they'll be seeking help at pregnancy resource centers and pregnancy medical clinics. So all of those people have to be ready for this and know what all this is about, and be ready to either be able to treat them if they're medical, or quickly refer them to a medical practitioner in the area who is willing and capable of giving the progesterone in order to give that woman a second chance at choice.
Lori, thank you very, very much for that call. Appreciate it. We have to take a quick break, and just so happens that while we go to that break, Assistant Producer Marie is here. Hello, Assistant Producer Marie.
Hello, my friends.
And why are you here?
I am here to talk about Radio Club. Right now, we're giving away a really cool talk from Trent and Cy about how to survive disasters, and you can get it by texting
Joining Radio Club.
By joining Radio Club. It's a Radio Club exclusive, not an exclusive, an exclusive. So if you text CA Live, all one word, to 44222, you will be prompted to sign up and you will receive your free talk. We'd love to have you over there. It's a great place to get highlights and a letter from Cy and just kind of know a little bit more of behind the scenes of what's going on in radio and what our plans are. And especially going into the new year, it's a good time to sign up so that you know kind of what changes we're making, and we get some feedback from you guys too. So
just get tons of stuff too.
Yeah.
We give away stuff all the time there at Radio Club, and stuff you won't get anywhere else. It's not like we're handing it out somewhere else. How do you join Radio Club again?
You're going to text CA Live to 44222.
Or you can go
to CatholicAnswersLive.com, and you can sign up there as well.
All right, CatholicAnswersLive.com.
Yeah.
Trent, as everyone knows, Trent is kind of my enemy, but he's a freak. He knows so much stuff, and we just sat down and started talking about what to do in a disaster.
Yes.
Turns out, apparently, he studies this stuff. He knew so much about a fire, here's what you do, a shooting, here's what you do, an earthquake, here's what you do.
I think we might have even discussed
nuclear war
really
at one point on
yeah.
it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So get it. It's fun. And it's a different one. You know, we did one recently with Tim. Have we done Carlo not too long ago?
And you can actually still get the one with Tim if you'd like to, if you text Tim Staples. But we have both being offered right now. So either CA Live or Tim Staples, whichever you want more. One is the Eucharist and the other is the How to Survive Disasters. But
join Radio Club. We'll give you whatever you want.
Yeah.
You join by going to CatholicAnswersLive.com and signing up there, or
text CA Live to 44222.
This is Dr. Scott Hahn, and stay tuned for more Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Radio gives us an opportunity to become part of a larger family. It can be so lonely when we are struggling in our faith or just try to live our faith on our own. But Catholic Radio connects us to that larger community of faith where we're able to get the support, the encouragement, and the grace that we need to not just struggle on, but to really celebrate all the blessings that God brings into our life through our Catholic faith.
Dr. Greg Popcheck thinks Catholic Radio is important. So should you.
Francis reminds us that it does not take a specialized degree in theology to become a great evangelist. We're all called to evangelize. Think about the woman at the well. After she encountered Jesus, she immediately went into the city and invited others to meet him as she had. You and I can go out now and do the same. And St. Paul Street Evangelization can help. Get involved today by contacting us at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, Pro-Life Open Forum. Dr. George Delgado, our guest, and lots of folks on the line, so I'm just going to keep moving. Rose in San Antonio, Texas, listening on the Guadalupe Radio Network. Holy smokes, it's the feast of Our Lady of Guadalupe today. Happy to have you with us, Rose. Your question for Dr. Delgado.
I'm calling because mainly for my daughter. When she was like 15, 16 years old, she had an emergency surgery because she developed a hemorrhagic, where she ovulates, but it developed into a blood sac, and it was formed over her ovaries. So she went in for an emergency surgery to relieve that. And I was told that she should have had a pediatric surgeon to do it, but since it was an emergency, it was just the, I guess, surgeon on call. And what happened is when he had taken, like, I don't know if they call it wedging, but he took off the ovary to the point where now when they try to look for it in a sonogram, they really don't, they have a hard time finding it. And she's also developed, like, that same ovary site, like a torsion. She hasn't been able to get pregnant since she's been married for many years. She's already 34 years old. But I don't know that her OB-GYN doctor has offered her anything other than the fact that they've done monitoring for, like, temperature to see if she's ovulating, which they say she is, but they don't know which ovary is doing that because she's having such a hard time getting pregnant. And so I don't know what else could they try that maybe this doctor doesn't know or can't offer, or I don't know if it's...
All right. Well, let's let Dr. Delgado respond.
Yeah, so, you know, she may be ovulating on that rudimentary ovary, or certainly on the other one, assuming the other one's fine. But she hasn't gotten pregnant all these years. There's obviously a problem. So the best thing would be for her to get an evaluation with a NAPRO technology physician that can look and see what's going on. And the philosophy of NAPRO technology is to understand and identify underlying defects, correct those defects so that the natural reproductive system can work the way it should, and that women can get pregnant through the natural marital embrace the way God intended, instead of circumventing, blocking, or destroying the reproductive system. And in Texas, there are a couple of different NAPRO technology doctors. There's Dr. Jeremy Kalamandrides in Austin, and there is another one in San Antonio, and I'm blanking on his name right now, but you can certainly look him up. I would go to naprotechnology.com and then look for NAPRO technology doctors in San Antonio area where you are and who can help you with that. So naprotechnology.com would be the way. You can also check the website of Fertility Care Practitioners of America. They also have a listing of the NAPRO technology doctors throughout the country, and you can look at that.
Okay, that first doctor in Austin you said was
Jeremy Kalamandrides, Kalimides.
Okay.
Jeremy,
okay.
First name. Yeah.
All right, we will leave it there. Thank you so much, Rose. We go now to Amber in Rochester Hills, Michigan, listening on the radio there. I don't have a call sign, so we'll just say welcome from Rochester Hills. Amber, your question for Dr. George Delgado.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. So I had a miscarriage a few years back, and the doctor at the time that was going to perform she said that she had to perform a DNC to remove the baby. And I basically argued with her multiple times that there should be other ways to remove the fetus. And then, according to her, and she still argued with me that that was the only way to remove the baby. Is there I was about 10 weeks pregnant. Is there any other way that possible that could have happened?
Well, let me ask you a couple of questions first, just to clarify. When the doctor said that she needed to do a dilation and curettage, or DNC, was at that time, was your baby already dead?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Yeah. So once the baby is already dead, then it's really it's a medical prudential judgment as to what's the best way. At 10 weeks, you can do a couple of different things. There are really three options. One is what we call expectant management. That's to wait for the body to recognize that a miscarriage has occurred, and oftentimes the body will then start contractions and push the baby out. Now, at 6 to 7 weeks, that's almost always happens. At 10 weeks, sometimes it's not going to happen. The body just won't recognize it. But you can still try and wait and see what happens. If the woman doesn't want to wait, or if she's waited and nothing's happening, you know, after a couple of weeks or however long the doctor wants to give it, then the other two options are to give a medication that causes contractions. In this case, it's called misoprostol. Misoprostol induces the uterus to contract. And misoprostol is used for a variety of things. It turns out it was initially developed to treat stomach ulcers. It's not used much for that anymore. It is used at the end of pregnancy to help with induction of labor to cause so-called ripening of the cervix. And it unfortunately is used as part of the medical abortion process. It's given 24 to 48 hours after mifepristone, the medication we discussed earlier that causes the death of the baby, to cause the contractions. But in this case, it's used for an ethically good reason, that is to empty the uterus of the remains of the baby that's already died. So that is one that's very common. It can be used at 10 weeks and can be used very successfully. Then the third thing would be that surgical procedure that you had, the DNC. And as to why the doctor insisted on that, I can't tell you for sure without knowing the particulars of the case, but in general, we do offer those three treatments, the expectant management, the misoprostol to cause the uterus to contract, or the surgical procedure.
Okay, Amber?
All right. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Thank you very, very much for that call. Dr. Delgado, pregnancy-related questions today, and that tends to happen when you're on. We get a theme. We get going in a direction, and we get a lot of calls in that direction. We did not talk about end-of-life issues today. It does strike me that we hear lots of news, though, about countries and in the United States expanding suicide and in some cases even euthanasia, and in some cases even euthanasia that the patient did not request. Any news on that front, or do we just continue down a bad road there?
Well, unfortunately, we're continuing down a bad road. Right now, there's a big push in Maine, the state of Maine, to have physician-assisted suicide approved. And the other states where it is approved now are California, Colorado, Hawaii, Montana, Oregon, Vermont, Washington, and also in the District of Columbia. Physician-assisted suicide, generally the laws are very similar in all the states, and that is where a patient who has a six-month prognosis of living that is usually verified by two physicians and wants to end his or her own life is given the legal right to obtain lethal doses of medications from a physician and then takes those medications his or herself. Then, of course, the problem with this is that, number one, we're aiding and abetting a suicide, which we should never do. Instead of giving that person good palliative care and good support, it's just similar to if a patient had a six-month prognosis and were sitting on the ledge of a building ready to jump off. We wouldn't nudge that patient, encourage that patient to jump off. No, we would try to talk that patient out of it. We should be doing the same thing here, but this is the medicalization of killing. And we know that the slippery slope leads to voluntary euthanasia, where a patient asks that we kill him or her, and then to involuntary euthanasia. And that's happened in Belgium and in the Netherlands.
Wow.
And they're euthanizing children. children and babies.
Oh, Lord. Lord, help us. We need help in these times. Dr. George Delgado, thank you so much for coming and sharing this Pro-Life Open Forum with us. Coming up next, in just a few minutes, Carlo Broussard here to talk about overcoming obstacles to the Catholic faith. Right back with more Catholic Answers right after this.